Let's turn back to Ephesians chapter 2 to continue our consideration of this mighty epistle written to this church of Ephesus. And we're about to look at verses 11 to 13. Someone like to read those for me, please. Ephesians 2, 11 to 13. Thank you very much. Once again, Paul compares the position they occupied in the past with the position which they then occupied, and talks about their being Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcised by those by that which is called circumcision made in the flesh by hands. Now, Paul spoke of circumcision on several occasions in his epistles, and we'll just briefly look back and ask ourselves, what did circumcision symbolise or represent? Some folks say it symbolises a new birth experience, but does it?
Death of the flesh.
Death of the flesh. Okay, of the old heart, did you say?
Of your own works.
Of your own works. That's better, yeah, right. Now, when we go back to the original introduction of circumcision, it was back in Abraham's time and is recorded in Genesis chapter 17. Now, Abraham had used his fleshly body to produce a child, destined, he thought, to be the child of promise, but coming into this world after his own works. And consequently not acceptable to God in heaven at all. And when the time came that Abraham was shown the error of his ways, he was called upon to circumcise himself and his children as a symbol of their consecration to use their flesh after God's direction and order in righteousness and truth. Now, to the Jew, circumcision became the outward sign and was more important than the inner conviction. To them, circumcision was the all in all. It itself was the end of itself. And they lost sight of that which is symbolized, and therefore lost sight of the principle of righteousness by faith versus righteousness by the law. Now, because of this, what attitude towards circumcision did the Gentile world hold, and was it still hold towards religious circumcision? It despised it, right? Now, during that time when they were Gentiles in the flesh, they were without Christ, they were aliens from the Commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. What is an alien? Right, not in outer space necessarily. It's a stranger, it's a person born to another country. You know, you think about wartime in this world, like the Second Great World War, the First Great World War, and an Englishman, for instance, might face a German across no man's land, but the Englishman and the German are both men, they're family men, they have wives and children back home. And in peacetime, they could be very good friends. Now, why is one where he is and the other where he is? Because of where they are born. They are strangers to each other because of their birthplace. And likewise, those of us who are born of Satan are strangers and aliens to those who are born of Christ. Strangers, foreigners from each other, as this verse points out. And needing, of course, that reconciliation which comes by being brought into one family, of which Christ is the husband and Christ is the head. So, aliens and strangers from the Commonwealth of Israel, having no hope without God in the world, but now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been made nigh by the blood of Christ. Now, why is this? Let's read verses 14 down to 18. Someone like to read it, please.
For he himself is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity. That is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace. And that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were afar off and to those who were near. For through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father.
Thank you very much. Now the basis or the reason why these strangers become friends and fellow believers and brethren who can fellowship together is because Jesus Christ is our peace. A very strong statement indeed. It doesn't simply say that he makes peace, but he is our peace. And what way is Christ our peace? How does he become our peace? He himself.
If we have his life within us, then we no longer have the old man within us. That enmity against God and against God's character is gone.
Right. Now, that's quite right. Now, back there, there were Jews and Gentiles, physically or nationally, and they hated each other very, very deeply and vehemently. The Jews hated the Romans hated the Jews, and so on. Now, what was the real root of their hatred? Pardon?
What was in
them? Right, what was in them. While they had in them the enmity against the law of God, naturally, of course, they hated one against the other, even though neither of them had the law of God in their hearts. They still hated each other with an implacable hatred. Now, when men sign a peace treaty, how much real value is there in that when it's signed by worldly people? Not much at all, as has been proved over the past 50 years or more, when treaties have been torn up and nations which made treaties have gone to war against each other. But when Jesus Christ is implanted in the heart, then he is peace wherever he is. Therefore, there's peace in our hearts, and consequently, all those within whose hearts that peace is found naturally have peace with each other. And that's why Paul says he is our peace. He himself is our peace. And that's a very comforting fact, because it's good to know when Jesus Christ abides in the heart, we do have that peace which passes all understanding, and can remain peaceful in the worst possible kind of circumstances. And so he's made both one, has broken down the middle wall of division between us. Having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace. Now, when did Christ abolish in his flesh the law of commandments contained in ordinances? At the crucifixion, right? Now, what is this law of commandments contained in ordinances? Yes, it's a ceremonial law, isn't it? So it's works of the flesh? Well, it's a law of commandments contained in ordinances.
It's also the law of sin and death, which would be the broken moral law.
It would have to be more than just the ceremonial law by itself, because God never intended the ceremonial law to be something that should be enmity between man and God.
Right, but how did it become that?
In order to them trying to obtain righteousness by their own works through that system.
Right, so it had become an enmity, right? It was never designed to be such. God never intended to be so, but it had become that. Now, to confirm this, let's go to 2 Corinthians 3, verse 3 for a moment, and or perhaps I should take Galatians 3:19 first of all to illustrate the point, where Paul talks about the Ten Commandments in the same terms. Galatians 3, verse 19. Let someone read it for me, please.
What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And it was appointed to the angels by the hand of a mediator.
Good. Now, to what law does Paul there refer?
The moral law
of Ten Commandments given on Mount Sinai, which was added because of transgressions and became the schoolmaster to lead us to Christ, as you read in verse 24, is it of the same chapter? Yes. 23 and 24.
But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith.
And 25.
But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor.
Good. Now, God gave the Ten Commandments written upon two tables of stone as a tutor or a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. But when we arrive there, we no longer need that tutor or schoolmaster. Now, had the Jews in Christ and Paul's day turned that law into a yoke of bondage?
Yes.
Or was it fulfilling the purpose God sent into the world to fulfill? No, it wasn't. It had changed from a blessing to a curse. Back to 2 Corinthians 3 now for a moment to follow this point through. So we're going to read verse 1 to 3, please, first of all. 2 Corinthians 3, verses 1 to 3.
Do we begin again to commend ourselves, or do we need, as some others, epistles of commendation to you or letters of commendation from you? You are our epistle written in our hearts, known and read by all men. Clearly, you are an epistle of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but by the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of flesh, that is, of the heart.
Mm-hmm. So in verse 3, Paul talks about two manifestations of God's law. And what were those two manifestations? One written with ink, the other written where?
Heart.
On the heart. One the letter of the law, the other the actual spirit and life of the law. Now, this distinction must be kept very clearly in mind if we wish to understand what Paul talks about in Ephesians and also again in Galatians. Let's go a little further now and read verse 4, 5 and 6.
We have such trust through Christ toward God, not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think of anything as being from ourselves, but our sufficiency is from God, who also has made us sufficient as ministers of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit, for the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life.
Thank you very much. Now Paul says he'd be made a minister of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. Why? The letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Okay? So Paul had been emancipated from the old system of preaching the letter of the law, which killed and did not bring life and blessing to those who sought to obey or to gain righteousness thereby. Now finally, let's read from verse 7 down to verse 13.
But if the ministry of death written and engraved on stones was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of the glory of his countenance, which glory was passing away, how will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? For if the ministry of condemnation had glory, the ministry of righteousness exceeds much more in glory. For even what was made glorious had no glory in this respect, because of the glory that excels. For if what is passing away was glorious, what remains is much more glorious. Therefore, since we have such hope, we use great boldness of speech, unlike Moses, who put a veil over his face so that the children of Israel could not look steadily at the end of what was passing away.
Thank you very much. Now, once again, Paul is contrasting the ministry of death and the ministry of life, the glorious ministry and the more glorious ministry. Now, very obviously, of course, the glorious ministry was that which was written on two tables of stone and served a purpose for a limited period of time, namely, of course, to bring them tutorially to Jesus Christ as a schoolmaster and to reveal to them their undone condition and the need of a Saviour. In other words, the tables of stone were a picture of the people to whom they were given, a people who had hearts of stone, but on which hearts of stone was written the letter of the law, the knowledge of what God required. And that picture of them was designed to show them that they needed to discard that heart of stone and receive a new heart altogether, namely a living heart of flesh which could respond to the commands of God and love even as he loved. Now, when you find, as we do in the Adventist Church today, for instance, that the law is upheld as the model of what people are to be, then this, of course, is not the purpose which the Lord put the law into place. Let me say it again. When a church upholds before the people the tables of stone as the model that they are to copy, this is a perversion of God's purpose in that law. And that which is designed to be a blessing becomes instead a curse, because when you behold, you are changed into the same likeness as that which you behold, and you become even more stony hard than before when the stony law becomes the model of your behaviour. Now, a schoolmaster is for us, is he not? Is a schoolmaster a blessing?
Yes.
Most definitely, he's a blessing. But when the law ceases to be a schoolmaster, becomes an object of emulation, it becomes what? Something against us, something which is a curse and a detriment to our experience. So, a perverted law, be it the moral of the ceremonial law, then is a curse, something which is against us and must, of course, be taken out of the way completely. Going to come back to Ephesians a moment now and see how this principle applies in the same situation. Now, by the time Christ came to this earth, what had happened to the ceremonial law? Had been perverted? Movement's rightful place? Misused? Was it deceiving the people? Certainly. It was against them in every sense of the word because of the perversion of this glorious provision which God had made for them. When Christ came to the temple for the first time and saw the suffering lamb, he began to see in that suffering lamb a picture of his own mission and his own ministry. But what did the people see? Right, the way to continue sin, become a cloak or a covering for their sinfulness, right? So therefore, that law had become something against them and not for them. It became a misleading factor in their lives, become an instrument in Satan's hands to destroy them. Now, when that situation arose, there's only one thing left to do, and that was to do away with it, which Christ, of course, did on the cross of Calvary, and turned their eyes instead toward the great and glorious sanctuary up in heaven. Now, Paul realized this, of course. Let's go to Hebrews for a moment to note how powerfully Paul drew upon the Old Testament sacrificial system to declare that it prefigured the ministry of Christ up in heaven. Now, in the Jewish system, of course, the sanctuary was the central point with its furnishings and services. And Paul begins to look at this in Hebrews, the 8th chapter, and verse 1. Someone like to read it for me, please? Or verse 1 and 2, I should say, yeah.
Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty of the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man.
Thank you. Now, Paul is making reference, of course, to the Old Testament sanctuary, first of all as the type or shadow of heavenly things, and points to Jesus Christ as being the high priest of the sanctuary up in heaven, which was pitched by God and not by man. Now, coming to verse 4 and 5 and 6, please. Same chapter.
For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For, see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern shown to thee in the mount. Now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises.
Thank you very much. Now, when did God say to Moses, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain? When did God say that? Well, first of all, did God say that? Did he? Aren't you sure?
Say which? Could you repeat the question?
The question is, did God say the words, see that you make all things according to the pattern?
Yes.
Right, that was God who said there. When did God say that?
To Moses on Mount Sinai when he gave the instructions for the building of the temple.
Right. And did Moses and the people exactly carry out God's word?
Yes.
Precisely. Let me get this Eye of Ages again and we'll get confirmation of that. I think it's page 208, if I remember correctly. Page 208, Desire of Ages. And with great exactness, the instruction of God was carried out by Moses and the people in the building of the sanctuary and the establishment of the sacrificial system. Right, start on the bottom of the page. When Moses was about to build the sanctuary. Someone got it, please?
When Moses was about to build the sanctuary as a dwelling place for God, he was directed to make all things according to the pattern given on the mount. Moses was full of zeal to do God's work. The most talented, skillful men were at hand to carry out his suggestions. Yet he was not to make a bell, a pomegranate, a tassel, a fringe, a curtain, or any vessel of the sanctuary, except according to the pattern shown him. God called him into the mount and revealed to him the heavenly things. The Lord covered him with his own glory, that he might see the pattern, and according to it all things were made. So to Israel, whom he desired to make his dwelling place, he had revealed his glorious ideal of character. The pattern was shown them in the mount when the law was given from Sinai. And when the Lord passed by before Moses and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands and forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Exodus 34:6-7.
Thank you very much. Right, now this statement makes it very clear then that God was the architect of the sanctuary building, correct? God was the architect. And the builders were Moses and the people, who had to pay the closest attention to every detail in that sanctuary, even a tassel and a bell and a pomegranate, every last little detail must be made exactly as God directed it should be made, right? Did they carry out the work as God directed them? Precisely. So how much participation did Satan have in the architecture of the sanctuary? None at all. He was completely and totally excluded. This was entirely and only from God and nowhere else but him. Now, it doesn't mention the sacrificial system in this particular paragraph, but very obviously, of course, what was the sanctuary without the sacrifices? Nothing. There had to be the building and the services of the building in order to reveal the plan of God to save mankind. So then, when God said to Moses, "See that you make all things according to the pattern shown to you in the mountain," they did just that, and God was the sole architect of the building and of its services, while Moses and the people built the building according to God's plan. Now, come on a little bit further now to chapter 9, and we do find that Paul begins to talk in terms of sacrifices and furniture and so forth in the sanctuary building. Let's take chapter 9, verses 1 to 5, please. Yes. Chapter 9, verse 1 to 5.
Then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service and the earthly sanctuary. For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part in which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these we cannot now speak in detail.
Paul, he describes very briefly and adequately the two apartments in the sanctuary, the holy place and the most holy place, with their appropriate furnishings. And we, of course, are quite familiar with that, so I shan't take time to detail them. Now let's go to verses 6 down to verse 8. Where we find that the two apartments each had their own special list of services.
Now when these things had been thus prepared, the priests always went into the first part of the tabernacle performing the services. But unto the second part, the high priest went alone, once a year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the people's sins committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit indicated this, that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was still standing.
So there were the two services, the daily and the yearly, combined to give the people total deliverance from their sin problem and fit them for the kingdom. Although we recognize, of course, that the actual sanctuary itself, the Old Testament sanctuary itself, did not have that power, but revealed and prefigured the work of Christ in the sanctuary above. Now, verse 9 then and 10 indicates that all this was a type or a symbol of something better yet to come. Verses 9 and 10, please.
It was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to the conscience, concerned only with foods and drinks, various washings and fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of reformation.
Good. So Paul there talks in terms of a counterpart or antitype appearing, which would be revealed by the Old Testament services and the building in which those services were conducted. Now in verses 11 to 15 we find that Jesus Christ fulfills that role, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood. 11 to 15, please.
But Christ came as high priest of good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle not made with hands, that is, not of this creation. Not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once for all and obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of the heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And for this reason, he is a mediator of the new covenant by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance.
Mm-hmm. Good, let's pass on now to verse 23 to pick up the 23 down to 28.
Therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with the blood of another. He then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself.
27-28.
And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time, apart from sin, for salvation.
Mm-hmm. Now, Paul certainly sets forth the true purpose of God in the sanctuary service in these verses, a purpose which is perverted by the Jewish people, of course, and as I said yesterday, every time that the Jews apostatize, what does Satan certainly do? He cast down the sanctuary and took away the daily services in that sanctuary. Let's come back then to verse 11 and 12. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is not of this creation. Which tabernacle is obviously being referred to there?
The heavenly.
Not with the blood of goats and calves, of his own blood, he entered into the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Now, Jesus Christ obtained eternal redemption upon the cross, but he must minister that from the heavenly sanctuary in order for us to be saved. Let's go to Hebrews 7:25 to confirm that point. Hebrews 7, verse 25. Someone like to read it for me, please.
Wherefore he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them.
Thank you. Now, he's able to save to the uttermost. Why? Because he ever lives to make intercession for them. And the ministry of Christ in the most holy place is just as needful for our salvation as was his death upon the cross. I'd like to read that to you from Great Controversy, where the point is made very clear and plain. It's about page 490 or thereabouts, I do believe. It makes it clear that Christ's mediator is just as necessary. What Christ obtained upon the cross, he now ministers from the sanctuary up in heaven. I've got a long book there. Here it is, way over here. Right. Page 490, I do believe. Let's just quickly check it out. No, it's page 489. The intercession of Christ on man's behalf in the sanctuary above is as essential to the plan of salvation as was his death upon the cross. So that without the heavenly ministry, we can't be saved at all. Even though Christ did die upon the cross and successfully paid the penalty, we still need that sanctuary service to bring about the application of what Christ obtained upon the cross for us. Now, verse 13 of Hebrews chapter 9. With the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled the unclean sanctifies the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Now, what did the sprinkling of the blood of the heifer achieve? The purifying of the flesh as a symbol of what? The purifying of the Spirit in due time. Now, coming on down to verse 18, therefore not even the first covenant was dedicated without blood. At whose command? I ask you, at whose command? God's command. Right? Now, that's confirmed in the next two verses. Let's read verse 19 and 20, someone, please.
When Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool, and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you."
Thank you very much. Now, I said this would confirm the point that God gave the command. And Moses said, "This is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you." So at whose command did they sanctify with blood?
God's
command. Right? Now, verse 23, we find now a contrast between the earthly and the heavenly sanctuary.
Therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these.
Good. A very valuable scripture, this one, because it confirms that sin actually is taken into the sanctuary up in heaven. Now, therefore, it was necessary that the copies of things in heaven should be purified with these. What does the word these refer back to?
The earthly, better things.
Well, the blood of bulls and goats, does it not?
Yes.
Right. But the heavenly things themselves are better sacrifices than these. Which was the better sacrifice? Christ's sacrifice. Now, in the Protestant world, there's great difficulty. In fact, they find it impossible to believe that sin actually goes into the heavenly sanctuary and therefore becomes unclean. But this verse confirms, of course, that the heavenly sanctuary must be purified with better sacrifices than these. Now, do you clean the cleansed? Or do you clean the clean?
No.
Or do you clean the unclean? The dirty or the besmirched? So that when the heavenly sanctuary had to be cleansed, what must it first have become?
Polluted
or unclean. And there's no question about the fact that literally the heavenly sanctuary does become unclean by what? The presence of confessed sin, which is stored there in the sanctuary until the great day of final atonement, when the most holy place and the holy places are cleansed from sin, which is then placed upon the scapegoat or back upon the sinner as the case may be. Now, does the Old Testament sanctuary type, which was so precisely ordained by God and designed by God, does it teach that the sanctuary itself becomes unclean? Well, let's think about it for a moment. When a person in the encampment became conscious of a personal sin and realized that sin in him was an uncleanness in him, and when that person came to the door of the sanctuary, the sin came along with him, did it not? Right? And when he confessed over the head of the victim the sin which he'd committed and called upon God to forgive that sin, confessing both what he was and what he had done, and the blood was taken into the first apartment, by this means the sin was, through the blood, transferred to the sanctuary. Let's go to page 418 in the book Great Controversy to confirm this point, which is very much at the heart of the message we teach and believe today. Page 418 in the Great Controversy. Right, the paragraph begins, "The ministration of the earthly sanctuary consists of two divisions."
The ministration of the earthly sanctuary consisted of two divisions. The priest ministered daily in the holy place, while once a year the high priest performed a special work of atonement in the most holy for the cleansing of the sanctuary. Day by day, the repentant sinner brought his offering to the door of the tabernacle, and placing his hand upon the victim's head, confessed his sins, thus in figure transferring them from himself to the innocent sacrifice. The animal was then slain without shedding of blood. Says the apostle, there is no remission of sin. The life of the flesh is in the blood. Leviticus 17:11. The broken law of God demanded the life of the transgressor, the blood representing the forfeited life of the sinner whose guilt the victim bore was carried by the priest into the holy place and sprinkled before the veil behind which was the ark containing the law that the sinner had transgressed. By this ceremony the sin was, through the blood, transferred in figure to the sanctuary.
Thank you, that's sufficient for the moment. Now here's the picture then of the actual transfer of sin from the sinner to the sacrifice to the sanctuary, as laid out in this paragraph. The sinner came before the door of the tabernacle and placed his hand upon the victim's head and confessed his sin, thus in figure transferring them from himself to the innocent sacrifice. Now let's bear in mind what was done in figure back there is done in reality in the heavenly sanctuary. Let's see if I can just find the statement which says that... somewhere here on page 420, the second last paragraph, such was the service performed, and so on.
Such was the service performed unto the example and shadow of heavenly things. And what was done in type in the ministration of the earthly sanctuary is done in reality in the ministration of the heavenly sanctuary.
Thank you. And note those words. what was done in type in the ministration of the earthly sanctuary was done in reality in the ministration of the heavenly sanctuary. So that when back there the sinner placed his hands upon the victim's head and confessed his sins over the victim, there was a typical action upon his part, which is done then, which then and now symbolizes the actual transfer of the sin from the sinner to the victim, right? We must recognize type and antitype and the reality versus the ceremonial. The next step was that the sinner killed the lamb with his own hand, signifying the fact that we are the slayers of Jesus Christ in reality. Then the blood, representing the forward life of the sinner, was carried to the holy place and sprinkled before the veil. And by this ceremony, the sin was, through the blood, transferred in figure to the sanctuary. Whereas, of course, in the New Testament situation, it's done actually in the case of every truly confessing person. So that the sanctuary does become defiled with the actual presence of the sin which was previously in us, right? And is transferred there by the ministry of blood, in type in the Old Testament sanctuary, of course, and an antitype today in respect to the New Testament sanctuary. Now, we're at the end of verse 23 in Hebrews chapter 9, and the rest of the chapter deals with Christ's ministration in the heavenly sanctuary along the same lines. Now, that was a very beautiful and wonderful gospel revelation to those people then and to us today. And I ask you very simply and plainly, how could we today know where Christ is, what he's doing, without the sanctuary service and a sacrificial system? How could we know? We couldn't. We would be deprived of a truth which is vital for our present and eternal welfare. We'd be lost, completely lost without that knowledge and light, because we must enter with Christ into the most holy place of the sanctuary and by faith be with him there if we are to receive the atonement and finally be saved. But tragically, all this became perverted. And who was the author of its perversion? The Satan loved the sacrificial system. He hates it, because he recognized that in that is the revelation of Christ and his salvation. And therefore, Satan implacably hates the sacrificial system. And that's why every time that Israel was overthrown by her enemies, the sacrificial system was terminated until they repented and came back into God's grace again. So come back to Ephesians now, the second chapter, verse 14 or 15. And we look at this expression, the law of commandments contained ordinances which was against us. Now, I say again that the law of ordinances as given by God was not against anybody, excepting, of course, the enemy of truth and his followers. But when Israel perverted that law until it became a perversion of the truth and a darkness instead of light, it certainly was something which was terribly against them and which Christ did away with when he died upon the cross of Calvary, but not in its original pure form as God gave it on Mount Sinai to Moses and the people of Israel. Now, Christ did this so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace. Now, basically, the two men brought into union with the Jew and the Gentile, but the union of the Jew and the Gentile was but a type of the union between God and man. I'll just make a little diagram on the board if I can bring it up here at the moment. I really appreciate the statement by Paul in regard to the incarnation of Jesus Christ, because it does beautifully illustrate the union between God and his people. So first of all, we place God at the top of the page as the great source of life and everything else, Jesus Christ as the great connector, and man as the dependent receiver. Now, Jesus Christ has the life of God, and he also has the life of man, so that in him we find two joined together, God and man. So Christ has the life of both the Father and also the created beings. Can you all see this now if I hold it over here? So here, this circle symbolizes the life of God. This circle symbolizes the life of man, and Christ is in both circles. He's both man and God, so he made in himself of two, namely God and man, one new man, thus making peace between God and man and between Jew and Gentile. Right. And this certainly pictures to my mind the incarnation of Jesus Christ in a very beautiful and graphic form, and shows how we can become one member or the members of one family, in the family in heaven and on earth. Time's about gone, I guess, so I have to pause at this point shortly. So let's close with the thought then, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace, in this case, between God and man, and between man and man as well. Time's gone, so if you have any questions or observations, we'd be glad to discuss them at this point. Yes?
So how do you address E.J. Wagner's confession, where he says that sin was followed up in the life of Christ and that there's no sanctuary in heaven, and that Christ is the true sanctuary, etc., etc.?
In what book did he write that?
He wrote in his, I think it's called his Confession.
Final Word of Confession.
It's Wagner's Confession, I think is what it's called.
When he was dying?
No, it's a letter he wrote to a man just before he died.
Well, it sounds like he lost the truth, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would say.
It sounds like, yeah. I'm not going to judge him, but it was...
Well, maybe you'd rather read the book. It's a short pamphlet, read it first.
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
But it doesn't sound too healthy to me. Yes, Frank.
In a sense, any command of God is reacted upon by the flesh as an ordinance and is attempted to be kept by the flesh as a work to obtain righteousness, so that even ordinances like baptism, the Lord's Supper, and so on can be classed as... laws that were abolished at the cross, if they are kept in the sense of works.
Right, that's quite right. Yes, a good point. Good point. Any further questions? Yes.
If you do something wrong, right, and then Christ shows you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then if you give it to him right away and ask him to take it out of you, is that a sin?
No.
Because
temptation. Have you done wrong? Did you say?
No. If you.
Been tempted.
Okay, you have something in you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't know about it, and then God shows you, and you give it to him right away.
Oh, I got your question now. Secret sins or hidden sins are covered by the blood of Christ vicariously, and it is as if they weren't there. When they're shown to you and you confess them, if you do it right away, there's no sin against you at all.
Okay, so we can make an end of sin. And then if God shows us something uncovered, and we give it to him right away, then that's not counted as a sin.
That's right. Very good. Okay, let's take a break for a few minutes. Let's come back at 4:30, shall we? 4:30.